Hello, everyone, and welcome to the very first episode of the Saturn Vox podcast, where discussions of philosophy meet the liminal space we weave in dreams. This is your host, consciousness theorist and ontological skeptic, Mikala. This week, in order to give my listeners a firm grasp of the foundational beliefs in the fields of metaphysics and epistemology upon which I build the rest of my occult practice, I have invited my friend Joshua Madera, technomancer extraordinaire, to join us. So stop your crying and get in the robot, Shinji, because we are about to embark on a conversational dance through consciousness theory, the constraints of language and sense perception, and the wild art that is the robot. If you find this podcast interesting and want to show some support, consider checking out the Patreon at www.patreon.com/SaturnVox. I can also be found on Instagram and Facebook at SaturnVox. Likewise, Joshua's work can be found on Instagram at Eldritech and also online at eldri.tech. Now, before you ask yourself, did she just use a Neon Genesis reference? The answer is yes, without shame. And with that being said, let us begin. Hey Josh, how are you doing today?
Hello, I'm doing well, thank you.
Well, it's great to have you here. Do you think that you could start off with maybe giving our audience a little bit of information about yourself?
Sure. I am Joshua Madera, aka Technomancer. I do weird things with technology and the occult. I am a chaos magician most of the time. I've been doing that for going on a couple of decades now. I combine art and magic and technology in strange ways, including robots and robomancy, which is the practice I've been most occupied with for the past several years.
Wow, that's a very extensive and impressive background. I guess for the sake of the listeners, would you mind just explaining what it means to be a robomancer or to practice technomancy, like what that means to you?
I think very simply it is just doing magic with robots, and that can mean a lot of different things. The word robot both denotes and typically connotes something very specific, but there's also some debate about what exactly a robot is or is not, or whether this or that machine or entity constitutes a robot per se.
And that really works well with chaos magic and the philosophy behind chaos magic as well, doesn't it?
Sure. This is such a big subject, I'm not even sure.
Putting you on the spot right from the start.
Sure. So in my own practice, I tend to focus on three aspects of what I call the robot of art, which is a robot purposed for the practice of magic. And those three aspects are the robot as tool, which is a very familiar characterization of robots. You know, the idea of the robot being an extension of the Robomancer's own body, in a sense, and connected to the history of robots, which have much to do with, you know, work and slavery.
Yes.
And drudgery and these things. The word robot itself coming from a Czech word, which means drudgery or servitude. And the second aspect being the robot is actor, typically in ritual theater, but also alluding to agency more generally. And the third aspect being the robot as fetish, being a receptacle or a house for occult or spiritual agents.
Wow, that is truly fascinating. I love what you said about the robot being related to the word drudgery and being a tool. It makes me think about both tool as extension of the body, as well as our self-identity and exploration of self-identity through the extension of a tool. So with that being said, in what ways does the philosophy that you have towards robomancy inform and engage the way that you practice chaos magic?
Yeah, I don't know that robomancy would have developed for me outside of chaos magic. My magical career, such as it is, did not begin with chaos magic, but chaos magic became the most significant part of it when I encountered that. And within chaos magic, I was afforded a freedom to experiment with technology in a way that I often find is frowned on in other kinds of magic.
I'm fascinated. Like, I guess my question is, when you say you do things like you can use the robot as a fetish per se, are you attempting to trap like common known spirits? Or is it more like you're trying to trap the idea of something within? But I guess I'm really fascinated by what your idea of what you think becomes embedded into the robot.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's very open-ended. To begin to answer that, going back to the first part of your question, for me, a robot is no different than any other material object. In some senses, is no different than any material object that one would do magic with, right? So one might, one could put a spirit into a brass vessel. One could evoke a spirit through a sigil. One might encounter a stone that seems to have some kind of spirit or intelligence or something associated with it. And we find this kind of animism all throughout magic, right? All throughout the occult, in all kinds of cultures. And there are various ways of looking at that ontologically, like what is the spirit exactly in a real sense. I don't think that we have, I don't think that we have very good language for articulating that stuff in a scientific kind of way. I think that a lot of that language has come from, religion and magic of the past, and we have a kind of plausible reasoning around a lot of that stuff. And we might think of a entity that we call a spirit, and we're not even really sure what that is, being trapped or contained within this or that object. But I don't think that we really have a good understanding of what that means. But we do know how we can enact those things. We do have a kind of artistic or expressive language for doing that already. And it is ritual as it exists and has been practiced for years. And various magical ways of accessing and interacting with these kinds of things that, again, I don't think we have a good analytical language for. We have a lot of really good synthetic language for it.
Oh, wow. I love that. So it's like we can't talk about it directly using analytical language because, well, A, it will result in paradox, and B, it's ineffable. But we can talk about it in a synthetic way, I guess, maybe pictorially, like, say, through cards, or ritually through our movements, or even in something as simple as, say, the way smoke dances in the air.
Sure. So for me, the robot embodies a spirit just like a deck of cards might embody a spirit, or a stone might embody a spirit, or a wand might embody a spirit. It's a combination of how I interact with it, what I do with it, what it inspires me to do with it, what it kind of tells me to do with it, or how to interact with it. What for me distinguishes the robot from these other material objects that might house spirits or be receptacles of spirit or whatever kind of language we want to use. What's interesting for me about robots is that they are dynamic in the physical space, right? So someone might paint a spirit, and they might do magic with that painting, and someone might look at that painting and say, wow, that's charged with energy or spirit or, you know, noumena or whatever. But the painting itself is physically static. It doesn't move. It doesn't respond to things that occur in its environment, vis-a-vis the robot, which does respond to things that occur in its environment. It can be programmed to be reactive and to be expressive and to be performative in the physical space. So that for me is, to me, what makes robots interesting as, and computers more generally too, what makes those things interesting for me in the magical space.
And that's where you're getting this other factor of robot as actor is from, this ability to extend and give you an interactive quality that you might not have with, say, an icon or a candle, per se.
Right.
You know, my next question leading from that would be, when I charge the robot, and let's say, you know, I have charged it and I have a pretty good idea of what I believe the spirit that I have contained into the robot, which has kind of, I guess, would be done energetically over the material programming that I would have to do first. So there are like multiple layers of this. First, I program what I want the robot to do, but then I trap a spirit into that tool and give it the ability to enact itself through the program, does this robot fetish now have the ability to have a consciousness in the way that magicians tend to believe that, you know, their spirits or deities or ancestors or whoever they're trying to contact have consciousness?
Yeah. In my experience, the answer to that question is yes. And again, you know, I don't know that I would use the phrase trapping a spirit. I see the robot, and one of the reasons I call the robot of robomancy the robot of art is that I see it as being a material expression of mm-hmm. the spiritual, right? Again, just like a painting might be or a dance might be. But as you mentioned with the robot, you know, you have to build it, you have to program it, and you are composing it again in the same way that you might compose any work of art.
I love this, like coding as song.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, coding as song and poetry, and the actions and the interactions of the robot being a kind of poetry in space. And, you know, you can program a robot to enact a ritual. You can program a robot to do divination using randomness of all kinds, of many different kinds of randomness that you can use. And, you know, again, for me, it comes back to that idea that, you know, if you have, let's say that you have a leather pouch full of bones that have some kind of autonomous agency,
sure.
Right, that you have experienced or encountered or attributed to these things. And so when you consult the bones, you have some kind of ritual that you go through and you ask your question and you have a kind of respect for and a relationship to the bones that is a magical one. And it's a very non-trivial relationship typically. And so when you cast the bones, you know, there's no analytical language really for saying how the bones end up wherever they end up in a synchronistic or meaningful way for you in the context of the divination that you're doing. But as anyone who does divination knows, that if you have that kind of relationship with your bag of bones or your deck of cards or whatever it is, you most certainly have, you know, these wild synchronicities that you experience with these things when you read them. And so for me, it's the same kind of thing with the robot. It's just, you know, people, there's, I guess the robot has a lot of cultural assumptions about it that can make that difficult for some people to see quite the same way that I do.
Are you implying like people's fear of robots taking over?
Sure, it could be that. It could be, again, this idea that technology and magic are somehow at odds with each other, or that computers and modern technology are inherently anti-magical or anti-mystical or anti-spiritual. And I think that I use that word non-trivial a minute ago. I think that there is certainly an aspect to modern technology that needs to be called out, that it is often employed to trivialize things. You know, algorithms break things down into small steps that can be accomplished by an automatic process, whether that automatic process is carried out by a person or a machine or some hybrid of those two things. I think that for robomancy to quote unquote work requires developing a non-trivial relationship to technology, right? Like I have people ask me sometimes, like, you know, when they find out that I do magic with technology, they're like, wow, so, you know, are you coding like programs to hack the universe and stuff? And I'm like, that's cool. Yes. But what does that even mean? Right. Like, so, you know, just as somebody who crafts magic wands and makes really lovely wands, just as they have to know a lot of the material properties of, let's say, wood, if they're using wood to make these, they have to understand how their tools interact with the wood. There's a lot of techne, a lot of technical knowledge that goes into that craft. You know, for me, that's how circuits work and mm-hmm. how computer code works. But still, at the end of the day, what I'm making with those things is not, I'm not trying to trivialize magic. I'm trying to non-trivialize technology.
Oh my God, I love that. Okay, so you're not trying to trivialize technology. You're trying to untrivialize magic. Wow. Okay, so I feel like if people are like that, if they have this issue with magic and technology, the first thought that came to my mind, I've not personally had a conversation with anybody about that up until now, but I've always been pro technology, so I have to kind of ask myself, well, how might the other side see it? And I guess there may be this thought that some people have that witchcraft, you know, we work with nature, we get our hands in the dirt, the plants have their correspondence because they are alive and they have energy, and it's, you know, the same. That's why I use specific plants to make my inks if I am writing my sigil, you know, like this life that I take from the earth then transformed into extra oomph for my will, per se. And maybe other people might view, you know, computers and robots as somehow cold and somehow not alive, and therefore that might make them feel weird about bringing it into witchcraft. But if that is, you know, what causes this fear in people, my response would just be to say, you know, electricity is a form of energy that is alive. There are quartz crystals in, you know, the chips inside your computer. Just because it doesn't look like a natural piece of material doesn't directly imply some sort of unnatural quality, and that just is probably brought about by our need as humans to categorize things according to, you know, what is most known about each category, when really if you break things down, most things can fit in most categories. Am I making sense?
Yeah, sure. And I think you touched on a lot of interesting stuff there. I think that the antithesis between magic and technology that I mentioned earlier is definitely a subset of an antithesis between natural mm-hmm. and artificial things. But again, you know, people practicing magic use artifacts all the time. And yeah, there's the whole idea of magical correspondences, which are different depending on what kind of magic you're doing. But I think that for me, what is interesting about the so-called natural world in juxtaposition to the human created world, which of course is as much a part of the natural world as anything. Like we are not, humans are not apart from nature. But I think that there is something to be said for the wildness of non-human things,
yes.
Right? There's something to be said for the wilderness. There's something to be said for all of the other non-human entities that we share this planet and this galaxy, etc. You know, who knows how big it really goes. And there is a kind of, I don't know, maybe that word wild is really what I'm going for here. There is a wildness to uncivilized things that exist out in the world that do not exist for us. They are not manufactured by us for our benefit. And we coexist in this world with those things. And for me, that has something to do with where the robot starts to get really interesting, because, it's neat to make a robot that can, for example, draw a giant sigil on the ground. That's maybe an example of the robot as tool, right? So I can say, hey, I want to draw this sigil, but I want to draw it on a 30-foot floor, and I can make a robot that can do that. But, in that sense, the robot is, again, just kind of an extension of me. And when we start playing with robot divination, you know, robomancy per se, and working with randomness and developing these kinds of non-trivial relationships with the technology that we're using, those things begin to become more wild. And they become capable of being unpredictable, of being surprising, of being intelligent, of being wise, of being all kinds of things that that we typically deny to those kinds of artifacts. Ada Lovelace, who I love her. I love the history of, Babbage's analytical engine and Boolean logic and all of these things that have gone into the computer as we know it today. But I think Lovelace wrote at one point, she said, "It is desirable to guard against the possibility of exaggerated ideas that might arise as to the powers of the analytical engine. The analytical engine has no pretensions whatever to originate anything. It can do whatever we know how to order it to perform. It can follow analysis, but it has no power of anticipating any analytical relations or truths. Its province is to assist us in making available what we are already acquainted with." And I think that the idea of the robot as slave is very much in line with that idea. The idea of the robot being this machine that I can tell it what to do, and it goes out and it does it, and it doesn't complain, and it doesn't argue, and it, but again, the robot that I'm interested in, the robot that I am interested in, the machine that I am interested in, is the wild one. It's the one that does create. It's the one that does do things.
Yeah, it's the one from that Isaac Asimov short story where the detective had to figure out which one was able to think for itself and inspiring all the other robots to rebel.
Yeah.
I love this idea. I think whenever we first pull up an image of robot in our mind, the first thought or adjective that we would use to describe it would not be, you know, wild. In fact, it would be to build some sort of sci-fi civilized surroundings around the robot, almost as if to encase it in this idea of science equaling civilization. But at the same time, almost all of our robot myths, all of our stories of robot, directly deals with humans' fear of robot, because robot is unknown, robot is wild, its ability, it's our understanding that robot has the potentiality to become human in a way.
Yes.
And that scares us both because of what we know human is capable of, and also because of how we want to limit robot as a civilized thing when it is in fact something wild.
Sure.
You know, this whole concept really brings to my mind a story by Ted Chiang. He's a short story writer. The movie Arrival is based off of one of his shorts. So if you have seen that, then you already know it's about, you know, extraterrestrials and linguistics and how we might be able to communicate with aliens, which is really on board with what we're talking about here. But I'm thinking of the short entitled 72 Letters.
They weren't robots, they were golems. Clay, golems made out of clay, but they could be embedded, similar to a coding language, with glyphs or notes or combinations of the 72 Hebrew letters that could code the golem basically to do different things. And they did a prolonged experiment in a way of trying to figure out, well, what code, what word is going to get it to grasp its hand and fully close its fingers. And they had to design it down to every minuscule muscle, you know? And the end implication, I guess, that you were meant to take away from the story had to do with the potential processes of the divine or some sort of maker, outside maker, who used maybe not coding the way that we understand coding, like we are coding a computer, but codes of words of power, codes of glyphs of power embedded into the psyche, which over time develops in the golem's ability to become more and more human each day.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of stories about the human artifact desiring to become more human, right? From Frankenstein to Pinocchio. And I think that is interesting. You know, the question of, can we create an artifact that has a human level intelligence or whatever, is, I think that's an interesting question for sure. But I also think that I think that the machinic phylum, as Manuel de Landa called it, I think that is more wild than just robots emulating human beings. I think that there is potential there for robots and machines to evolve into other things that may be inhuman or non-human or potentially anti-human. I don't know.
Sure.
But I think that there are, I think that that is interesting too.
Yes, that's kind of what Her was about. And I think Orson Scott Card plays a little bit with that in his AI that appears in the Ender's Game series as well. How might consciousness, if it is developed from something that is connected to the web and to every other computer through that network, what might it have the potential to be beyond sure. our own understanding of consciousness? Well, all of this kind of leads me to another sort of on topic area that I wanted to go into, which is, I guess, the potentiality for our own existence to have been a part of a program, potentially, or the limitations of our consciousness to perceive reality as it might be in its totality.
Yeah, well, those are big questions.
Well, that's kind of like a thing that was also being expressed in the Haiyang story. We emulate a creator, sure. and of course this is very Abrahamic, but we emulate a creator, and so then we create. That's why we are making golems. That's why, you know, we're making AI as this sort of cyclical or even fractoral pattern that is constantly wanting to create or produce in the same way that it was produced, seemingly just by instinct.
Sure. And, you know, that what you just said about this Abrahamic succession and relationship between God the creator and human the created and human the creator and robot the created, right? Is that kind of that kind of story over and over again. And I think that, you know, that idea of homo faber, right? Man the maker, or humanity the making species. And you and I talked a little bit about this before, where there are lots of animals that make things, and depending on what we think of as being making or creation, of course, you know, according to Maturana and Varela, life is differentiated by being self-making, by being autopoietic, right? Self-creating. That is what distinguishes living things from other things. And, you know, beavers build dams and et cetera, and some animals use tools, and absolutely some robots use tools, but you know, there are examples of these things of making, of production, all over in the natural, quote unquote, natural world, but nothing does it quite like humans do it, right? Like the way that we create art, the way that we create religion, the way that we create science, the way that we create architecture. And I mean, so much. And again, I don't think that those things are unnatural. at all. I think that they are what we produce in the same way that a beaver produces a dam, or a mollusk produces a shell. But we do it, for some reason or another, on a way different level. And I think that has a lot to do with language. But this idea that we are differentiated by being makers, and that we are acting in the image of our creator by making, it's an interesting idea. I think spiritually, I don't really resonate a whole lot with that kind of a creator. I don't resonate a lot with a demiurge, even as much as I am a maker, right? Like that is such a part of my history, and the work that I do is building and making and being part of maker culture years ago was a huge part of how I got into all of this robomancy stuff.
You know what, you talking about language as being what maybe pushes us kind of beyond the realm of the animal, kind of made me think, well, gosh, I wonder if it's possible that we programmed ourselves, because all programming really is speaking to the computer in the language we've taught it to speak in. And it's bound by the constraints of its programming language, which is its code. And we as humans are also very constrained by our linguistic perceptions. You know, like I couldn't tell you if what I see as blue is the same thing as what you see as blue. It may look like a color I've never seen in my entire life to you, but because we both call it blue, it's become blue. But I don't know. I guess I have wanted to do a deep dive into the history of language, because I haven't. I couldn't actually say what the current science is, where we developed it originally. But it is an interesting thought experiment to think about, like, let's say there is no creator in the Abrahamic sense. Let's say that being is just, you know, pure will and just purely is, and we just circumstantially arise from it and are beheld to it in some way, and language naturally arose from us through that, but we were really the wielders of how language was going to develop. And is it possible that without even realizing it, we've put unnecessary constraints on ourselves? George Lakoff talks a bit about this. I think I've brought this book up to you before in Metaphors We Live By. One of my favorite parts about that book is when he's talking about, why do we perceive argument as war? Why is it that the metaphors that we have to tell about getting into an argument or a disagreement with someone are the same kinds of metaphors and words that we use when we're talking about going into battle? And how might it change the way that I interact with the other if our language held a metaphor in which
disagreements were a dance? I love Lakoff. Lakoff helped to inform Fakanie and Turner's philosophy of conceptual blending or conceptual integration theory, which I don't want to get too into right now, but is something that has inspired a lot of my own process, really, creatively. But just a few of the things that came to mind as you were saying that you know, there's, well, going back to living things as being autopoietic, autopoiesis, poiesis being the root of the word poetry, right? And
I love that word.
The sort of casual idea that goes along with that, or image that goes along with that, of speaking something into existence. That's a very spell-related idea, a very magical idea. And it's very related to my own interest in computers and robots. Originally, I wanted to understand how computer code, which was this esoteric language, becomes spooky action at a distance, right? How is it that I can write this code and then machines move? And they might move on the other side of the planet through networking. And so that whole thing to me is very magical at its core. Although I'm able to distinguish between magical and non-magical aspects of it. But, you know, again, I thought of Maturana and his idea that language is used to by humans to coordinate interactions in consensual spaces. Consensual meaning literally to sense together with. So there's this lovely illustration that Maturana did. It's actually, now that I'm mentioning it, it's kind of difficult to describe, but it's two eyes looking at a flower and two dialogue bubbles that wrap around each other coming from the eyes, where one of them is saying, "Do you see the flower?" And the other one is saying, "Yes, I see the flower." And this is how a flower comes into being. So there's this thing out there, we can assume. A flower has its own flowerness out in the world. But we have our particular relationship with the flower. And through language, we construct the reality of the flower through coordinating our experiences with one another through language. This goes back to what you were saying about the color blue, right? Maybe what you see when you see blue is totally different than what I see. Yet through language, you and I are both able to point to something and agree, yep, that's blue, right? And that's red and that's yellow. And the idea of consensual coordination through language being a very dance-like idea to me, and there being a very poetic and dance kind of quality to the language of love and to the language of ritual. Those are some of the things that came to mind. And also thinking about Lakoff and how his ideas about metaphor and Fécanier and Turner's ideas about metaphor and conceptual blending, how related those things are to the philosophy of embodied cognition and
yes.
the idea that our experiences as physical entities in a physical world, how much that informs our language and our activities and our conceptions and how we think about things. And you find a lot of this in neuro-linguistic programming and stuff too. But to bring all of that back to something we were talking about earlier, like, you know, do we live in some kind of a synthetic world, or, you know, what is the reality that we actually inhabit? And especially apropos of consciousness, I wonder a lot about the embodiment of consciousness and also the disembodiment of consciousness. So, you know, we experience, for example, color. the way that we do, because our eyes perceive light the way that they do, and our brain interprets the information the way that it does. And color is not so much a property of something out in the world as it is, this is kind of a buzzword these days, but an emergent property or an emergent thing of this interaction that we have with something that mm-hmm. has color. Okay. Right. But so there's this idea that that maybe consciousness doesn't really exist. Maybe it's an epiphenomenon or a side effect or something of our thinking and our cognition and our being, you know, brainy, meaty things in the world. But when we dream and when we do psychedelics, I think that we often have experiences of colors and textures and sounds that are so radically different
yep.
from what we experience in our bodies. And I don't think that they are merely collages or reconstructions of things taken from a bunch of a bunch of embodied experiences, right?
No, yeah, I absolutely agree. And I'm actually a huge proponent of Thomas Metzinger. He's a ontological philosopher who's done a lot of work with neuroscientists. And he has a belief that he calls the ego tunnel. And what the ego tunnel is it's basically to imply what we call the ego, our consciousness, that which we perceive to be self, is kind of in this very Saturnal, binah way. We are constrained almost like a horse with blinders on their eyes by what the brain is able to process in an embodied state, in this dense third dimensional body. My consciousness, which maybe extends beyond the body, I believe, and so does Thomas Metzinger, but in these moments of present, in these moments where I experience time, this self is restricted to a tunnel, which is only, I'm basically, the tunnel and the walls of the tunnel are built of like how my brain processes color, how my retina works, things like that. So in that way, when we dream or we take a psychedelic, it's almost as if we remove the blinders, or maybe we widen them a bit, and now all of a sudden I can perceive more of what is going on in, you know, the quote unquote true reality. But otherwise I'm just beholden to dense time, space, bodily presence.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, what, going back to that idea of color and how we perceive color, you know, what would we see if we didn't have eyes? What would we hear if we didn't have ears?
Well, I often wonder that with animals all the time.
Yeah, you know, but of course we do see without, as you know, KRS-One says this all the time in his talks. You know, we do see without eyes and we do hear without ears every time we imagine something. And again, we can be very reductive about what imagination is and assert that it's just another cognitive process that, you know, that allows us to kind of reconstruct, or maybe to some degree generate visual data or audio data or whatever, when those things aren't actually present. But again, I feel like dreams and psychedelic experiences really strongly suggest that there's more going on there.
Yeah, I think when we as magicians or witches or however people want to self-identify, magic practitioners, when we go into trance or even just, sit down and attempt to have a visualized-based meditation, we are actively engaged in expanding our ego tunnel in those moments as well. I think when we open ourselves up to the receptive intuition, that's another way to widen your blinders. One thing that I find most of the literature kind of glosses over that I've actually started to become more and more convinced is an overlooked part of this equation. Everybody always talks about the mind-body problem. You know, that's the hard problem. But it's actually a threefold problem because the emotional body and the emotional sense, the felt sense in the body that dictates how our emotions respond, is almost a completely separate part of this equation that does seem to drive us both in an imaginative way and in like a will-building way, if that makes sense. I guess it does get brought up in some circles. It probably gets brought up in conversations of AI, because when people want to build their robot to be actually conscious, then it needs to have the emotional component.
Well, I mean, you know, affective computing and robotics has amplified for sure in the last couple of decades. The idea of a robot having emotions or being capable of having emotions is, of course, something we see all over in popular culture. We see it in Data of Star Trek The Next Generation. We see it in the Tin Man of Wizard of Oz and his heart, right? You know, the idea of, and I think there's a conflation there too of the idea of a machine that can feel emotion and a machine that has a soul. Because there's so much about emotion and affect that is entangled in the idea of soulfulness.
But this is just another product of human hubris, because, I mean, how am I to know whether or not my plants have emotions? I believe they do. I know that there are a lot of people who would believe, you know, agree with me, and a lot of people who wouldn't, but I think that they probably do. It just looks different and is expressed different than how my own human conception of what quote unquote emotions are meant to look like.
Yeah. Yeah. Which brings a lot of things to mind, you know. The last time you and I talked, I think we talked about my mama bear, baby bear robot example. And, you know, the idea that I could program, I'll just go through the example again for the sake of your podcast.
Yes, please do.
The idea that I can create two robots, one larger than the other one, and I can program the larger robot such that whenever something it cannot identify approaches too close to the smaller robot, the larger robot acts in a very aggressive way
towards whatever that unidentified entity is, to the purpose of scaring that thing away. And, you know, I might make the robot's eyes glow red, smoke can come out of its mouth, it can yell, it can move very quickly, whatever, right? But the idea here is that that robot, that mama bear robot, is expressing anger. It's expressing something that if we were just looking at the robots, just like we might a couple of bears out in the world, and we saw this interaction happen, we might say, wow, that mama bear robot is really pissed off, or is very aggressive, or whatever, is full of rage. There is, of course, something to be said for our projection onto the robot, just as we would onto the bear, of our own experiences with those things, with those states, and our expectations of those kinds of things. But, you know, and because, of course, we don't know what a bear is feeling when a bear does that or does anything. And we only know what you and I are feeling. We only know that through language, right? Through consensual sensing together, through talking with each other, and developing these very complex constructs that help us to make sense of and understand what is happening there. Now, we know that when we experience anger, there is a feeling that goes along with that, right? And that feeling can be very compelling, as it can with grief or with love or what have you. But and so someone might say, well, the robot is just aping an emotion. It's not, you know, it's not actually feeling anything. It's just expressing an emotion the same way that that you might paint something that expresses your emotional state. But of course, you wouldn't say that the painting is feeling that. But I think that the robot example helps to show us just how uncertain a lot of these things really are. And I mentioned Maturana earlier, that Maturana gave an interview in which he tells, you know, that he's talking about machines and emotions, and the interviewer says, you're just being metaphorical, right? And Maturana says, yeah, to some degree, but I'm also being isophorical, meaning also to some degree, I'm talking about two things that are really the same. And he says, I'll tell you about a machine with emotion, an automobile. When an automobile is in first gear, you barely touch the accelerator and vroom, off you go. It lurches forward. It's very aggressive, you know. And then when you're cruising down the freeway and, you know, you shift into fifth gear, the car is much more fluid. It's much more serene. And Maturana says that corresponds precisely to emotions in animals, which is that it's an internal configuration that changes the reactivity of the living thing in its environment. So whether the robot is feeling angry or not, it can have a change, an internal change of state that changes how it reacts to entities in its environment. It can act in an aggressive way, or it can act in a passive way. And these things all tie back to the relationship between emotion and, again, affect. And the idea of how things come into contact with one another and influence each other and have effects on each other. And I think that's all very interesting stuff.
Yeah, you know, that actually, well, it made me think about the felt sense in our body, which is kind of what the leading somatic psychologists are saying maybe is what promotes our emotional responses. It comes from exactly what you're talking about, how the body, the animal instinct that we experience to intense change in our body or in our environment, I'm sorry. And it seems like potentially the way that we as humans experience what we call emotions is this combination of the felt sense in my body that I'm afraid I need to either fight, flight, or freeze. You know, what gear do I need to switch into to respond to this stimulus, right? And we have specific bodily sensations that accompany these instinctual responses, but then our analytic selves try to break that apart or kind of stop that process through this containment of language, I think, in a lot of ways, by saying like, oh, you're just angry, oh, you're just sad, that instead of saying like, I am having an automatic response to outside stimulation, we try to make this experience more understandable and dissectable by giving it labels, when those labels vastly, I mean, really, I believe that there are very few words that match one-to-one with the thing they're meant to demonstrate or denote meaning to. But emotions in particular, the word anger, again, just like my version of blue, can be experienced in the body through the felt sense in a completely different way than for you than how it might for me. And it does seem like it is this weird back and forth between the body and the mind trying to make sense of these processes that give us, along with, you know, what society and other people, how they respond to these bodily responses. They say, oh, you're angry. And you go, okay, well, this bodily sensation must be anger, you know, and now I have a label for it. Now I can dissect it and somehow have control over it. And that was my tangent. I don't know where I was going with that.
I think that's great. And I think, you know, again, there's a lot there. I guess the contra distinction to the mother bear robot example that I just gave is the fact that we can feel an emotion and not act on it. Right? I can feel angry, but not act angry. I can feel sad, but not act sad.
Yep.
Of course, there are consequences to not expressing those things, whether they're positive or negative. That depends entirely on the circumstances. But, you know, I can feel sad and not allow myself to cry and get a lump in my throat, right? So there again, there's that distinction between what I feel and what I'm expressing or what I am acting out, which is admittedly very different from the robot example that I gave. There's also, you know, anyone who has suffered with anxiety and panic disorder or panic attacks knows that emotions have a mind of their own. And, you know, you can be suddenly beset by a strong emotional response that does not correspond to any stimulus that makes sense. And that's just another interesting facet of all of this stuff to me.
Oh, yeah. It's all so interesting, but of course, we've not really talked about anything that can be known definitively. But again, I mean, I think personally, I don't call myself a chaos magician, but I do have a lot of chaos magician leanings when it comes to philosophy. And it all, to me, boils down to everything we've just been talking about. It's like, I can't even prove that what I think looks like a foot is actually even a physical thing. If we start going down quantum mechanics realms, you know, so because of that, I would never want to make the claim that, like, I know for certain what created the universe and what causes consciousness and how magic works. And, you know, this is the truth. Because I can't know anything. I don't claim to know anything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think science is great. I think science has... I think one of the most important things that the science of the last few hundred years has taught us that is conveniently ignored most of the time, perhaps necessarily so, is just what you were saying, is that the world that we think we inhabit on a daily, casual, ordinary basis is radically different from the world as it actually is. And we don't even have access to the world as it actually is, but we've been able to access enough of it, enough new information, enough different ways of seeing things through the uses of instruments and through mathematics and through experiments that we know that it's weird, and it's weird all the way down.
It's weird out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love that. I think that adds to the joy of life because it does allow me to constantly have a sense of wonder that anything even is at all. I know sometimes when I talk about that I feel this way to people, you know, that I don't even know that the reality that I'm living in is, you know, true with a capital T, the way that I understand it. And they go, oh, that must be so depressing, or that must be you, that sounds so nihilistic. And I'm just, well, that's all about your perspective. I mean, because I do believe that you know, matter matters, right? Just because I don't think it's true with a capital T doesn't mean that I don't think that exploring this material universe the way that it is unveiled to me has no merit. And I wish more people were willing to look at it that way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I think that materialism has very tangible benefits, pun intended. But you know, there's obviously a lot that it doesn't explain. There are still deep questions that science and philosophy wrestle with. And these questions about consciousness and what is the true nature of the world or reality or existence or us, I mean, these are the ageless questions, right? Like, people have been wondering these things forever, and we're not really a whole lot closer to answering them. And maybe it's the nature of such questions that there is no ultimate truth or answer to them.
It's almost like a maze that is never ending. The more we move, the more riddles we, you know, the more we move forward, then we get presented with new riddles we have to solve, new doors, new pathways. And once we figure that out, we get to the next section. It's just another room of riddles and maze passageways.
Sure. And anything that we figure out could be turned upside down in the next moment.
Well, I guess that's as good a time as any to end the conversation. I appreciate you joining me so much.
Thank you for inviting me, and I always enjoy speaking with you. And I'm excited that you have this podcast now, and I look forward to hearing the episodes as they occur. And
thank you. I love talking to you too, and I think that this was a really fascinating topic. So I'm so glad that you were willing to go down the rabbit hole with me.
Yes, thank you very much.